The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading today from the December 13th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. As usual, we start with the main stories and how they were covered. The relaunch of Obamacare. What happened? President Obama relaunched his signature health care law this week, declaring that the troubled enrollment website was largely fixed, and kicking off an aggressive new campaign to sell the Affordable Care Act's benefits to millions of Americans without insurance. The Obama administration said it had successfully made emergency technical repairs to the healthcare.gov site and that it now works well for the vast majority of users. Officials admitted, however, that back-end connections that transmit applications to insurance companies are still being rebuilt. The site can now handle 50,000 users at once, according to the White House, and about 1 million people visited the site on each of the first 2 days after the December 1 target date for repairs. The White House, Democrats, and advocacy organizations will spend the next 3 weeks publicizing the law's benefits and urging Americans to reconsider signing up for insurance through the private insurance marketplace set up by the ACA. As part of that counteroffensive, Obama accused Republicans of trying to sabotage health care reform for partisan purposes and challenged them to propose an alternative way to guarantee affordable coverage to people with pre-existing conditions and the country's 40 million uninsured. "We're not going back," Obama said. That seems to be the only alternative that Obamacare's opponents have. What the editorial said. "Finally, a bit of good news on health care reform," said the Tampa Bay Times. "Now that the frustrating technical failures of Obamacare's initial rollout are being overcome, Americans are beginning to sign up for coverage they need." But Obama and his signature effort are nowhere near out of the woods, said USA Today. "The administration has wasted 2 months of a six-month open enrollment period, and people who want insurance that begins January 1st have only until December 23rd to sign up. Despite the front-end fixes on the website, the data being sent to insurers continues to have a disturbingly high error rate." "That could be a bigger problem than website pages that load slowly," said Bloomberg.com. "Insurers are missing crucial data needed to actually issue policies to people applying for them. Imagine the uproar if people who sign up through Obamacare visit a doctor in 2014, only to discover they're not signed up for the health plan they thought covered them." What the columnist said. "With the website largely fixed, we're now into the next phase of the healthcare battle," said Sean Sullivan in WashingtonPost.com. "Can Obama successfully resell his tarnished reform to the public? Or can Republicans scare people off by portraying it as a complete disaster?" "There is some reason for optimism," said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. "Some states that are running their own exchanges have seen a surge of real interest, with California signing up 80,000 people by mid-November and an additional 20,000 more every week. Soon, insurers will launch a massive national advertising campaign to persuade people to sign up. The rollout has been rough, but healthcare reform has come to stay." Don't be so sure of that, said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Changing the public's perception of Obamacare will require more than a good public relations strategy. Americans are angry that the law is creating a large number of losers, middle-class people who must surrender inexpensive plans bought on the individual market in order to subsidize cheaper policies for the poor. People now see that the presidential lie about people keeping their insurance and doctors was a deliberate attempt to disguise the reality that Obamacare is redistributionist. In the chaos of the past 2 months, the White House has quietly changed its definition of success, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. The administration originally hoped to sign up 7 million people this year, with 2.7 million of them young and healthy, to balance out the old and the sick. You won't hear Obama admit this, but the only goal that matters now is to get enough signups to keep worried Democrats and frustrated insurance companies from openly turning against the law. A program that survives until 2015, the White House figures, can be fixed. Our second main story, China's grab for airspace. A tense territorial standoff between Japan and China overshadowed Vice President Joe Biden's tour this week of East Asia, where he sought to ease hostilities over China's controversial new claim to airspace in the East China Sea. In Tokyo, Biden said he was deeply concerned by China's sudden decision last week to impose an air defense identification zone that encompassed the Japanese-administered islands known as the Senkaku in Japan and Diaoyu in China. The Obama administration responded immediately to China's assertion by sending two B-52 bombers through the zone and reaffirming its treaty obligation to aid Japan if it were attacked, though the Federal Aviation Administration subsequently advised American carriers to comply with the new regulations by identifying themselves to Chinese authorities before entering the airspace. Biden this week called on Japan and China to open communications. The only conflict that is worse than one that is intended is one that is unintended, he said. After Biden arrived in Beijing, the Chinese Foreign Ministry declared the airspace a fact, but a zone of cooperation, not confrontation. This is just the beginning, said Michael Auslan in Politico.com. Beijing has correctly gambled that the U.S. is too squeamish to oppose its regional ambitions. As a result, free aerial passage through international skies over one of the world's busiest air corridors has ended, and China has won a major victory. President Obama should be sending flying fighters and bombers through the air zone in daily shows of force. China has hardly won the showdown, said Max Fisher in WashingtonPost.com. In fact, its gambit backfired, embarrassing China while further uniting Japan, South Korea, and the U.S. against Chinese military assertiveness. Communist leaders took this foolish step to drum up hate against Japan and distract the population from China's growing domestic problems: environmental degradation, dire food safety, and rampant corruption. America should steer clear of this conflict, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. A struggle between Japan and China puts the U.S. in a lose-lose predicament. Washington is deeply connected to both countries, but still obliged to defend Japan. We were right to send in the B-52s to defend existing airspace rules, but now we should want this fight to go away. Our controversy of the week, Pope Francis, a Marxist economic message? American conservatives used to think of the Pope as one of their own, said Daniel Gross in thedailybeast.com. Thanks to the Catholic Church's stances on abortion, gay rights, and other social issues. But since he was elected in March, Pope Francis has startled the right by dramatically changing the Church's focus from divisive issues of sexual morality to the need to serve the poor. Last week, Francis turned up the heat, delivering a stinging critique of right-wing economic theory that wouldn't have sounded out of place on MSNBC or around an Occupy Wall Street drum circle. This wasn't the usual vague call to love the wretched and the needy, said John Nichols in TheNation.com. In a 50,000-word apostolic exhortation, Francis decried the new tyranny of unfettered capitalism, called the current socioeconomic system unjust at its root, denounced the self-serving tax evasion of the wealthy, and dismissed conservatives' cherished theory of trickle-down economics as ineffective and callous. The histrionic Rush Limbaugh captured the right's horrified reaction when he spluttered, "This is just pure Marxism coming out of the mouth of the Pope." The Pope's left-wing screed truly is a troubling development, said Andrew Studdiford in NationalReview.com. The charming and charismatic Francis is clearly determined to use the megaphone of the papacy to promote redistributionist economic policies of a type that have failed and failed and failed again around the world, including in his native Argentina. In the Soviet Union's workers' paradise, millions starved to death. Francis's writings betray a naive understanding of economics, said Joshua Scheer in Spectator.com. History has shown that the free market system is vastly superior to its alternatives at feeding the hungry and raising the living standards of entire populations. As the growing middle classes of China and India can testify, capitalism does not breed poverty, it alleviates it. Francis isn't calling for socialism, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. And his message isn't even purely liberal. In a portion of his encyclical most liberals prefer to overlook, the Pope also warned of the vacuum left by secularist rationalism and a throwaway culture in which even unborn life is sacrificed on the altar of selfishness. Still, as the first pope from the largely impoverished Southern Hemisphere, Francis is unmistakably charting a new course and tone for the Church, and doing so with a speed that few thought was possible. Who could have imagined until now a pope who would warn, as he did last week, of dour judges who remain intransigently faithful to a particular Catholic style from the past, or of smug rich men who content themselves in blaming the poor? We conservative Catholics shouldn't kid ourselves, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Francis is clearly issuing a challenge to Catholics on the limited government free market right. We should not react with sulking opposition, but by seeking to truly integrate an economic vision that remains conservative with the compassionate and communitarian values of our Catholic faith. The words of Jesus Christ himself should serve as a guide, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. What Christ taught unambiguously was that the first duty of any Christian is to share what he has with the poor and alleviate human suffering, and that the pursuit of wealth and material goods can be an absolutely evil, deceptive thing. True Christianity rejects the false idol of radical market triumphalism, and for the first time in our lifetimes, It's now coming to a church near you. On the briefing page, the executioner's lament states with the death penalty can no longer get a drug used in lethal injections, so they're improvising. Why is there a crisis? Stockpiles of a drug traditionally used in executions effectively ran out this fall. The 32 death penalty states had been struggling to maintain supply since 2011, when the sole American manufacturer of the anesthetic sodium thiopental announced it was ending production under pressure from the government in Italy, where its plant is based. Other European manufacturers also refused to provide the drug because of a European Union statute prohibiting the export of any product that might be used in capital punishment, especially since there's evidence that lethal injections sometimes cause agonizing deaths. Now, with hundreds waiting on death row, corrections departments have started desperately trying untested alternatives. We don't know how these drugs are going to react because they've never been used to kill someone, said Deborah Deno, a Fordham University law professor who studies lethal injections. Why did states start using lethal injection? Oklahoma became the first state to adopt the method in 1977. It was promoted by state medical examiner Jay Chapman as a humane alternative to traditional forms of execution, such as the electric chair, which often made witnesses uncomfortable. Those executed in the chair bucked and thrashed within their restraints for long seconds, and sometimes died with smoke and flames shooting out of their heads. Injections were meant to transform executions into a less gruesome affair. To avoid any comparison with putting down animals with a single drug, Chapman suggested a three-drug cocktail, and it quickly became a national standard. In 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that the cocktail did not violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Today, lethal injection is the primary method of execution in every death penalty state. And until this fall, Chapman's cocktail was the drug mix of choice. How does the cocktail work? An anesthetic, sodium thiopental, is administered by an IV in the condemned's arm to induce unconsciousness. Then a paralyzing drug, called pancuronium bromide, is added to halt his breathing, while a third drug, potassium chloride, stops his heart. In theory, the condemned shouldn't feel the effects of the second and third drugs, which actually kill him. But in practice, say critics and some scientists, executioners sometimes fail to properly administer enough sodium thiopental to produce full sedation in large inmates or don't inject it properly in a vein. As a result, inmates lie paralyzed but conscious for minutes as they slowly suffocate, feel a burning sensation in their veins, and go into cardiac arrest. In 2007, University of Miami researchers who studied executions concluded that the conventional view of lethal injection leading to an invariably peaceful and painless death is questionable. In at least three recent executions, a single dose of the drug cocktail hasn't killed the condemned, and more drugs had to be administered. It never occurred to me when we set this up that we'd have complete idiots administering the drugs, said Chapman. What about new drugs? Most have not been used in executions before, so successfully employing them requires guesswork. In October, convicted murderer William Happ was executed in Florida with a new three-drug combination that replaced sodium thiopental with the sedative Midazolam, a drug that causes memory loss and relaxation, but not necessarily unconsciousness. Hap took 14 minutes to die, rather than the planned 7. His head shook throughout, and his eyes remained open until the 10th minute. Other states have started using a single dose of the animal anesthetic pentobarbital to execute inmates, usually bought from loosely regulated compounding pharmacies. Texas's Department of Criminal Justice, which has carried out 37% of all U.S. executions since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, has gone the extra mile to keep its death chamber operating. The department allegedly submitted a falsified prescription to one compounding company, Pharmacy Innovations, ostensibly for patient James Jones, actually the warden of the Huntsville unit, which houses the execution chamber. Other states have bought lethal injection drugs with petty cash or individual employees' credit cards. Is the death penalty in trouble? In conservative states, support for executions remains strong, so they'll probably go on. But 7 states have put executions on hold because of controversy over lethal injections, and support for the death penalty is eroding nationally. A recent Gallup poll showed that support for the death penalty is at its lowest point in 40 years, at 60%, down from a high of 80% in 1994. Still, for those who strongly support capital punishment, the fact that lethal injections may inflict suffering on convicted murderers is beside the point. Why should it be FDA approved? Said New York Law School professor Robert Blecker, an advocate for the death penalty. This is not medicine. This is a method of killing. From the best columns in the U.S., Obama Needs to Clean House, by Ron Fournier in the National Journal. President Obama needs to fire himself, said Ron Fournier. Not literally, of course, but practically. He needs to shake up his inner circle so radically that it forces him to change his own behavior. 1 year into his second term, the president's approval ratings are at a nadir because of a series of blunders, capped by the disastrous Affordable Care Act rollout. If Obama is to regain his credibility, he needs to clean house. For too long, he has surrounded himself with fawning admirers who brush off any outside criticism, shield him from bad news, and indulge his aversion to the backslapping and deal-making of Washington politics. He's so cloistered that he had no idea the rollout of Obamacare was going to be such a disaster. Now heads must roll. Bill Clinton fired his chief of staff after voters turned on Democrats in the 1994 midterms. Ronald Reagan did the same during the Iran-Contra scandal. Both rebounded from their nadirs. If Obama is to do the same, he must bring in a new team that will force him to engage with his shortcomings as a manager. But saving Obama's presidency will take more than a change of staff. He must transform himself. From Michael Hiltzik at the Los Angeles Times, Closing the IRS Loophole. The Obama administration is finally tackling the IRS scandal, said Michael Hiltzik. Nope, not the bogus claim that it only targeted Tea Party groups for special scrutiny. The real scandal is that these groups got tax breaks and anonymity for political donations in the first place. Under IRS rules, nonprofit social welfare organizations, known as 501c4s, enjoy tax-exempt incomes and anonymous donations, so long as they keep their political activity to less than 49% of their work. The IRS envisioned C4 as a religious associations, veterans groups, and volunteer fire departments. But the rule was poorly defined, so it was exploited by partisan organizations such as Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS, which spent $86 million on political activity in 2012. That's why the beleaguered IRS tried to winnow out the violators by screening for terms such as Tea Party, Patriot, Progressive, and Green. But last week, the IRS issued tentative new guidelines that would deny tax-exempt status to any group clearly advocating for a political candidate or party. You want to spend millions on politics? Fine. You want to do it in secret by claiming to be a social welfare group? No dice. And from Daniel Callahan at the New York Times, letting death have its day. The fantasy of immortality is an ancient one, said Daniel Callahan. But modern medical science has breathed new life into this dream. Google is now funding a major search for ways to slow the aging process, and a host of scientists are exploring gene therapy, organ cloning, and nanotechnology as means to extend the human lifespan to 120 years and beyond. But is it wise to start down this road? Medicine has proved very capable at keeping elderly people with chronic diseases expensively alive, but not at keeping them young. At 83, I've needed major heart surgery to keep me ticking, and must use oxygen at night to keep my emphysema at bay. Just 10% of the population consumes 80% of all health care spending. Medicare costs are devouring our federal budget. Can we possibly afford to live even longer? Much less radically longer. Nature did not design our bodies to operate forever. And our world depends on each generation making way for the next. So let's stop the selfish pursuit of immortality. Our duty is to let death have its day. On the Talking Points page, drones, when deliveries come from the sky. Picture thousands of drones zipping across America, swooping down every few minutes to drop off books and electronic gadgets and box DVD sets, said Josh Duboff in VanityFair.com. Nope, this is not the premise for a dystopian novel. It's real. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos announced on CBS's 60 Minutes this week that within 5 years his company plans to use unmanned, GPS-operated octocopters to deliver purchases to a customer's door, just 30 minutes after an online purchase. The concept isn't new, said Jason Power in Wired.com. FedEx and other businesses have already discussed the idea of using flying robots to make deliveries, and groups as varied as farmers, photographers, and Domino's Pizza eagerly await the integration of civilian drones into the national airspace. But when a company as massive and wildly successful as Amazon gets involved, people pay attention. Sorry to spoil all the excitement, but just wait until one of these 100-pound octocopters crashes down on someone's head, said Peter Greer in csmonitor.com. Letting businesses and individuals fill the sky with drones is just too risky. In densely populated cities, swarms of propeller-driven aircraft loaded with goodies would be a constant hazard, not to mention lucrative targets for thieves, while in rural areas, they'd be target practice for people bored of hunting deer. Meanwhile, to reassure the Federal Aviation Administration that the octocopters won't snag power lines or crash into airplanes, Amazon may have to attach cameras to them, raising serious privacy concerns. Americans don't want camera-bearing drones looking down on them from above. 7 states have already banned police surveillance drones. Considering those obstacles, Amazon's announcement smells like a well-planned publicity stunt. Yet for all the showmanship, there's reason to believe that Amazon is onto something, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. The FAA is cautiously opening the door to domestic drone use, and the unmanned aircraft have already been successfully deployed in firefighting, disaster relief, and search and rescue. Now, with businesses beginning to dream up their own ideas, expanded use of commercial drones is inevitable. The technology needs to mature, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post, but it will. Drones just have too much potential to be grounded by fear of misuse. Scoff at Jeff Bezos if you like, but our robot future is already here, and it will inevitably take flight. The minimum wage, should it be raised? Americans are waking up to the fact that the minimum wage is no longer a living wage, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times. Voters in SeaTac, a Seattle suburb, last month backed a $15 an hour floor, more than double the $7.25 federal hourly minimum. Legislatures in California and Massachusetts recently lifted their minimum wages to over $10 an hour. And President Obama last week said he would support legislation to take the federal level to $10.10 an hour, and thereafter link it to inflation. A significant increase is long overdue, said Steve Call in The New Yorker. Congress has kept the floor at $7.25 since 2009. People supporting families on the minimum wage must get by on $15,500 a year, far below the federal poverty line. In order to survive, these poor working families supplement their meager income with food stamps and other government handouts. But by raising the minimum wage to $10 or above, we could lift millions out of poverty and ensure that the dignity of work includes true economic independence for all who embrace it. Raising the minimum wage won't fight poverty, said Douglas Holtz Eakin in HuffingtonPost.com. The reality is that 80% of minimum wage earners are not truly poor, according to the Census Bureau. Many have better paid spouses, while 46% are teens or young adults, many of whom live with middle-class parents. Poor people, meanwhile, will suffer the worst consequences of any wage hike, said Mario Loyola in NationalReview.com. Businesses will slash hours, fire employees, and raise prices to cover higher salaries. Progressives think a higher minimum wage protects the poor, but ignore the reality that nobody has an obligation to hire you. If it's illegal for supermarkets, fast food franchises, and retail chains to pay salaries dictated by the market, they'll just make do with fewer workers. It's a myth that raising the minimum wage leads to job losses, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. A study of states that raise their minimum wage found no significant impact on employment compared with neighboring states that didn't raise the wage. Most economists now support raising the minimum wage, and so do 76% of voters, including 58% of Republicans. Something that would help hardworking Americans might actually be politically possible. Incredible. Let's give it a try. on the Health and Science page, why you should eat nuts. Regularly eating a handful of nuts could help you live longer and healthier, CNN.com reports. A new observational study of about 119,000 men and women found that those who ate the recommended 1.5-ounce serving of nuts every day were 20% less likely to die over 30 years, compared with those who did not. Researchers also saw a 29% reduction in deaths from heart disease and an 11% reduction in the risk of dying from cancer. Even eating nuts occasionally correlated with a 7% lower death rate over 30 years. There's something unique about nuts, said Charles Fuchs in the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, who speculated that they may have an effect on inflammation or metabolism. But scientists said the correlation between nut eating and longer lives doesn't prove a cause. Nut eaters also tend to be leaner, less likely to smoke, and more likely to exercise and eat fruits and vegetables. Grim numbers on methane. The U.S. may be emitting 50% more of the greenhouse gas methane than previously thought. A new study by 15 climate scientists found that previous estimates, including those from the Environmental Protection Agency, seriously undercounted methane, which is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. These are pretty substantial numbers we're dealing with, and an important part of greenhouse gas emissions, Harvard environmental scientist Scott Miller tells the New York Times. Unlike prevailing models, the new estimate is derived from actual measurements of atmospheric methane, incorporating data from nearly 12,700 samples collected atop communication towers and through aircraft monitoring. Those measurements found at least 2.7 times the previously estimated methane in the atmosphere over Texas, Kansas, and Oklahoma. Far higher quantities than expected were found to come from oil and natural gas extraction in that area, along with substantial amounts from the burps and flatulence of livestock. Methane accounted for 9% of the U.S. greenhouse gas emission in 2011. But it traps 21 times more heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide does. Our article from the last word section today is titled, The Making of a Champ. When I was a bad kid, said Mike Tyson, two boxing coaches saw something special in me. The fact that they were sending me up to the state reformatory was not cool. I was with the big boys now. But Tryon wasn't a bad place. There were a lot of cottages there, and you could walk outside, play basketball, walk to the gym. But I got in trouble right away. I was just angry all the time. I had a bad attitude. Soon I got sent to Elmwood, which was a lockdown cottage for the incorrigible kids. Elmwood was creepy. They had big, tough-ass redneck staff members over there. On the weekends, all the kids from Elmwood who earned credits would go away for a few hours and then come back with broken noses, cracked teeth, busted mouths, bruised ribs. They were all jacked up. I just thought they were getting beat up by the staff because back then nobody would call the health department or social services if the staff were hurting the kids. But the more I talked with these hurt guys, the more I realized they were happy. Yeah, man, we almost got him. We almost got him, they laughed. They were boxing Mr. Stewart, one of the counselors. Bobby Stewart was a tough Irish guy, around 170 pounds, who had been a professional boxer. He was a national amateur champ. When I was in the hole, staff members told me there was an ex-boxing champ teaching kids how to box. The staff members that told me about him were very nice to me, and I wanted to meet him because I thought he'd be nice too. I was in my room one night when there was a loud, intimidating knock on the door. I opened the door and it was Mr. Stewart. "I heard you want to talk to me," he growled. "I want to be a fighter," I said. "So do the rest of the guys. But they don't have the balls to work to be a fighter," he said. "Maybe if you straighten up your act and stop being such an a-hole and show some respect around here, I'll work with you." So I really started to apply myself. I think I'm the stupidest guy in the world when it comes to scholastics, but I got my honor roll star, and I said yes, sir, and no, ma'am, to everyone, just being a model citizen so I could go over to fight with Stewart. It took me a month, but I finally earned enough credits to go. I immediately started flailing and throwing a bunch of punches, and he covered up. I'm punching him and slugging him, and then suddenly he slips by me and goes boom and hits me right in the stomach. Boosh! Ugh! I threw up everything I had eaten for the last 2 years. I didn't know anything about boxing then. Now I know that if you get hit in the stomach, you're going to lose your breath for a couple of seconds, but it comes back. I didn't know that then. I really thought that I wouldn't be able to ever breathe again, and I'd die. I was trying desperately to breathe, but all I could do was throw up. After everyone left, I approached him real humble. "Excuse me, sir. Can you teach me how to do that?" I asked. He must have seen something in me that he liked, because after our second session, he said to me, "Would you like to do this for real?" So we started training regularly. And after our workouts, I'd go back to my room and shadow box all night long. I started to get a lot better. After a few months of workouts, I called my mother and put Bobby on the phone with her. Tell her, I said. I wanted him to tell her how good I was doing. I just wanted her to know I could do something. I figured she might believe me if a white person was telling her. But she just told him that she had trouble believing that I had changed. She just thought I was incorrigible. Shortly after that, Bobby came to me with an idea. "I want to bring you to see this legendary boxing trainer, Cus D'Amato. He can take you to the next level." So one weekend in March 1980, Bobby and I drove to Catskill, New York. Cus's gym was a converted meeting hall that was above the town police station. There were no windows, so they had some old-fashioned lamps to provide life. Cus looked exactly like what you'd envision a hard-boiled boxing trainer to look like. He was short and stout with a bald head, and you could see that he was strong. He even talked tough, and he was dead serious. There wasn't a happy muscle in his face. "How you doing? I'm Cus," he introduced himself. He had a strong Bronx accent. He was with a younger trainer named Teddy Atlas. Bobby and I got in the ring and started sparring. I started out strong, really knocking Bobby around the ring. We would usually do 3 rounds, but in the middle of the second round, Bobby hit me in the nose with a couple of rights, and I started bleeding. It didn't really hurt, but the blood was all over my face. "That's enough," Atlas said. "But, sir, please let me finish this round and go one more round. That's what we normally do," I pleaded. I wanted to impress Cus. I guess I had. When we got out of the ring, Cuss's first words to Bobby were, "That's the heavyweight champion of the world." Right after that sparring session, we went to Cuss's house for lunch. He lived in a big white Victorian house on 10 acres. You could see the Hudson River from the porch. There were towering maple trees and large rose bushes on the side of the house. I had never seen a house like that in my life. We sat down and Cuss told me he couldn't believe I was only 13 years old. And then he told me what my future would be. He had seen me spar for not even 6 minutes, but he said it in a way that was like law. "You looked splendid," he said. "You're a great fighter." It was compliment after compliment. "If you listen to me, I can make you the youngest heavyweight champion of all time." I thought he was a pervert. In the world I came from, people do stuff like that when they want to perv out on you. I didn't know what to say. I had never heard anyone say nice things about me before. I was excited on the ride back. I was sitting with a bunch of Cuss's roses in my lap. I had never seen roses in person before, only on television. But I wanted some because they looked so exquisite. I wanted to have something nice to take back with me, so I asked him if I could take some. Between the smell of the roses and Cuss's words ringing in my ears, I felt good. Like my whole world had changed. In that one moment, I knew I was going to be somebody. "I think he likes you," Bobby said. I got back to my cottage and put the roses in water. Cuss had given me a huge boxing encyclopedia to look at, and I didn't sleep that whole night. I just read the whole book. I read about Benny Leonard and Harry Greb and Jack Johnson. I got turned out real bad. I wanted to be like those guys. They looked like they had no rules. They worked hard, but on their downtime they just lounged and people came to them like they were gods. I started going out to Cuss's house every weekend to work out. I'd work with Teddy in the gym, and then I'd stay over at Cuss's house. There were a few other fighters living there with Cuss and all his companion, and his companion, a sweet Ukrainian lady named Camille Ewald. When I first got to the house, I would steal money from Teddy's wallet. I had to get money for weed. I would hear Teddy tell Cuss, "It has to be him." "It's not him," Cuss said. I was excited about the boxing, but I became certain that boxing was what I wanted to do with my life after I watched the first Leonard Duran fight on TV at Cuss's house one weekend. Wow, that fight turned me out. It was so exciting. They were both so stylish and deadly, throwing punches so fast. It looked choreographed, like the two of them were acting. I was just amazed. I've never felt that feeling again. When I first started going to Cuss's, he didn't even let me box. After I finished my workout with Teddy, Cuss would sit down with me and we'd talk. He'd talk about my feelings and emotions and about the psychology of boxing. He wanted to reach me at the root. We talked about pretty abstract concepts, but he was getting through to me. Cuss knew how to talk my language. He had grown up in tough neighborhoods, and he had been a street kid, too. The first thing Cuss talked about was fear and how to overcome it. Fear is the greatest obstacle to learning, but fear is your best friend. Fear is like fire. If you learn to control it, you let it work for you. You think you know the difference between a hero and a coward, Mike? Well, there is no difference between a hero and a coward in what they feel. It's what they do that makes them different. Your mind is not your friend, Mike. Fatigue in the ring is 90% psychological. It's just the excuse of a man who wants to quit. The night before a fight, you won't sleep. Don't worry. The other guy didn't either. You'll go to the weigh-in. He'll look much bigger than you and calmer, like ice. But he's burning up with fear inside. The moment the bell rings and you come in contact with each other, suddenly your opponent seems like everybody else, because now your imagination has dissipated. The fight itself is the only reality that matters. The goal of all this was to build confidence in the fighter. Confidence was everything. But in order to possess that confidence, you had to test yourself and put yourself on the line. It doesn't come from osmosis, out of the air. It comes from consistently going over the visualization in your mind to help you develop the confidence that you want to possess. Cus laid all this out for me in the first few weeks that we were together. He gave me the whole plan. He gave me a mission. I was going to be the youngest heavyweight champion of all time. I didn't know it then, but after one of our first long talks, Cus confided in Camille. Camille, this is the one I've been waiting for all my life. This article was excerpted from Undisputed Truth by Mike Tyson with Larry Sloman. We'll wind down with some shorter pieces. This one from a section called It Wasn't All Bad. No one expected Jack McDonald to leave a large estate when he died. The elderly retiree lived in a Seattle convalescent home, collected coupons, and rarely bought new clothes. But when the former attorney passed away in September at the age of 98, he left behind an astonishing $187.6 million and willed it all to charity. McDonald's secret fortune, amassed over six decades on the stock market, will benefit the University of Washington School of Law, the Salvation Army, and the Seattle Children's Research Institute. The latter gift, worth $3.75 million a year, is the largest single donation to pediatric research in U.S. history. From a section called Only in America, Bellevue College in Washington State now offers applicants seven different options for their gender: feminine, masculine, androgynous, transgender, gender neutral, other, and prefer not to say. The college says the question will help it create better services and classes for gender variant students. And in our Good Week, Bad Week section, it was a good week for escaping. After a Swedish inmate suffering from a toothache broke out of prison to visit a dentist. My entire face was completely swollen, he complained. I just couldn't stand it. The escapee turned himself in and had one day added to his sentence. It was a good week for animal intelligence. After zoologists observed crocodiles and alligators balancing twigs on their snouts to lure and chomp on birds seeking nest-building material. The first time tool use has ever been seen in reptiles. It was a good week for earplugs after rowdy Seattle Seahawks fans screamed and jumped up and down so hard during their team's 34-7 home win over New Orleans that their celebrations produced a record 137.6 decibels and an earthquake measured between magnitude 1 and 2. It was a bad week for cat owners, after Japanese scientists found that felines have evolved to ignore their owners' voices. Cats, unlike dogs, have not been domesticated to obey humans' orders, said researchers. Rather, they seem to take the initiative in human-cat interaction. It was a bad week for con artists, after a man who sued Washington, D.C.'s subway system, claiming he'd slipped on a banana peel in an elevator, was charged with fraud when video footage showed him tossing the peel on the ground, stepping on it, and theatrically falling down. It was a bad week for the superstitious, after a river flowing through the Slovakian town of Mijava suddenly turned the color of blood. "It looks like someone slaughtered 1,000 virgins," said one frightened local. Police suspected that a slaughterhouse upriver had sprung a leak. 62% of Americans say they are worried about losing their jobs, a record high in surveys going back to the 1970s. Among Americans in households earning less than $35,000 a year, 75% say they worry about losing their jobs, and 54% already had their work hours or salaries cut. And finally, a quote from Benjamin Franklin: "When you're done changing, you're done." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.